Hello, and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate, one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Infertility is stressful for both individuals and couples, often causing significant strain in intimate relationships. Now, sometimes these stresses can lead to feelings of guilt and shame or symptoms of common mental health conditions like anxiety or depression. While fertility treatments in the medical field may be able to help the likelihood of conception, entering systemic therapy while undergoing these treatments can also be a helpful way to work through grief, worry, and all these other emotions that may be experienced because of fertility issues, especially when the assisted reproductive technology fails. Many MFTs may be aware of these challenges that accompany fertility issues and the common treatments for infertility. In therapy, those faced with infertility will be able to discuss options and make decisions about how to proceed. Therapy can also help couples deal with feelings of anger or frustration that may arise between two partners when only one person is infertile. In this episode of the podcast, I'm going to talk to Dr. Christy Kozer about her work in helping couples navigate complex decisions while maintaining their relationship after a diagnosis of infertility and during fertility treatments. And we're going to come from an attachment lens and Christy's preferred theoretical orientation, emotionally focused therapy, EFT. Dr. Christy Kozer is an author, speaker, and educator on the topic of reproductive mental health, trauma, and loss. Christy is a certified EFT therapist and supervisor. She has been invited around the country to lead her one-of-a-kind, love and enriched couples retreats. Those are designed to help couples learn new ways to find deeper connection. She has substantial experience in the creation of and facilitation of psychoeducation weekends based on the book Hold Me Tight, helping to establish the facilitator's guide with the late, great Sue Johnson in 2009. She'll talk about that on the episode today. She is a member of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine and has completed her postgraduate training in fertility counseling. She actively researches and writes about couple satisfaction during the various phases of fertility treatment. And I found out about her through a really great overview article published in the Family Journal titled Fertility Counseling with Couples. She also has created several self-help courses that she'll mention at the end of the interview and teaches a 10-month postgraduate fertility counseling course that is a fundamental first step for any mental health professional considering working with this population. I learned so much from this interview, and I am really happy to be able to share it with you. We will be back after our talk with Christy. Christy Kozer, welcome to the AAMFT podcast. This is one of our most requested topics, working with couples that are experiencing infertility or fertility issues. So happy to have you. So tell us about your therapeutic origin story and specifically how you got interested in working with individuals, couples struggling with fertility.
Yeah, great question. Happy to talk about it. I can't really talk about how I got interested in working with couples and infertility if I don't really talk about how I got interested in couples work just in general. And so I learned about attachment theory and EFT in grad school from my good friend now and professor, Dr. Anne-Marie Early in Virginia. And I got really interested in just what attachment theory was and EFT. And so did my first externship with Sue Johnson in 2008, drove all the way up from Virginia to Ottawa. Sue had just wrote Hold Me Tight. and was wanting to start running Hold Me Tight educational groups for couples. And so I said, I will help you. I will do this for you. And so I started running these Hold Me Tight educational groups for couples. I was one of the first in the US to start doing it, which is really exciting. But this kind of led to this opening of a relationship with Sue over the years as I, you know, would be in touch with her sometimes weekly about the data I was getting from my groups and how this was going to impact the facilitator's manual and how to write this. And I had time because I was very green and I was just graduated grad school. So I was in my residency. And so I had time to be doing this research thing on the side. But that really grew to in my relationship with Sue, and she invited me to help her lead a couples retreat in Kripalu in 2009 with her, which was super fun. We stayed the weekend up there. And then since then, we kept in regular touch. We were presenting at conferences together, seeing each other. And so she was a really huge cheerleader of a lot of my research that I was doing. I live in Amish country. I was born and raised in Amish country. I'm not Amish, but I know that's usually the next question. But I was using EFT with the Amish community. And so I would talk to Sue about that. And she was super excited that I was integrating EFT in the fertility counseling world too. So after she died earlier this year, I was looking back at some of our emails together and just reminded about how excited she was about the integration of EFT and infertility and some of that work. And so I had been building my practice over the last 15 years as a attachment theorist, a couples therapist. And then I, like many other people and many other clinicians, experienced my own journey in building a family. And that's where I became introduced to fertility counseling and started getting curious about how does all of this professional training that I've been doing in attachment theory and EFT. At that point, I was a certified EFT therapist and supervisor. How does this start? Like, what's the intersection here between my own personal experience too? And I would imagine the experience of so many others. So I spent my doctoral work researching, exploring that intersection, started writing professionally about it, teaching it. That's my origin story. It's evolved over many years. And I've met so many wonderful people along the way that have just mentored me and encouraged me. So I feel really lucky about the people that were put in my path.
And certainly someone I got to know pretty well over the first 20 plus years of my career, Sue Johnson. Actually, she was our first guest now in our sixth season on the podcast. And we've heard this story from so many people who she influenced, people that weren't trained initially systemically. This idea of anybody that was interested in EFT, Sue was interested in and mentored so many people. And so great to hear that. And that turns you on to doing this work and your personal connection to it, as we often have, drove it to the next level. And now you have really integrated. We're all about integration on this show. You've integrated attachment theory to this work. I love hearing this. If you've gone through this as a therapist, you have a lot of information, but the information around infertility and its possible treatments can just be so overwhelming. So let's just do briefly in our time today, infertility 101. What are the main causes of infertility? And what do you think is the most important medical information, psychoeducation that couples therapists should know when working with this population?
I think the question itself is so important because it implies that there are medical things that need to be done. Some mental health professionals don't even recognize how much medical treatment is involved in fertility treatment. And so certainly there are people who struggle to get pregnant who can track ovulation and have timed intercourse and be able to get pregnant at home without the need of using a clinic. But the majority of people are going to go through some form of medical treatment. So when they come into your office, it's important to assume, or I'm sorry, not assume that, or I'm sorry, let me back up there. It's important to assume that they are probably going through some kind of medical treatment and to educate yourself on what that is, especially if this hasn't been your story or you've not encountered this. So typically an infertility diagnosis is probably going to fall into one of three categories. It's either going to be a female factor, meaning that it's hormonally related or there's some kind of hormone dysfunction there. But they'll do some ovarian reserve testing just to see where your ovarian reserve is at, which can impact egg production and egg quality. And they do that through blood work and ultrasounds. And this is typically at a specialty like fertility clinic or a reproductive endocrinologist. There's also ovulatory factors. PCOS is a very common diagnosis in the fertility world. And then there's some physical issues for a female factor too. This can be the shape of the uterus. There can be some uterine and tubal factors. Some women have one tube removed, or maybe one tube is blocked, or both tubes are blocked. Or some women struggle with like fibroids or polyps within their uterus too. So there's a lot of testing that's done right initially for people to figure out what category they're going to fall into. There are male factor infertility as well. And this could really fall into absence of sperm. And that can be from maybe an injury that they sustained. There are some genetic conditions too that really impact sperm production or just even the presence of it in general. Low mobility, motility, ejaculation issues, erectile dysfunction. We see a lot of that too. Exposure to toxins. We're seeing that more and more with the microplastics and things like that can really impact sperm quality. And then undescended testes too. It can be a more female factor related, a more male factor related, or the dreaded third category, which is unexplained. And I say dreaded because this can be one of the hardest diagnoses for couples to process because we don't really know what's going on. We've ruled out female factor, we've ruled out male factor, but we're still not successful. And so we're doing treatment. Not me. The physicians are doing treatment in a direction that they think would be helpful to explore, but we don't really have a diagnosis. And that can be really hard for couples to hold what that means just because treatment is not free for a lot of people. It's very expensive and emotionally very expensive as well. And so for couples with an unexplained diagnosis, that can be really hard for them.
Another challenging thing, unless you know you have a pre-existing condition, generally, you're right. They're not going to come and talk to a couple's therapist about that until they've been seen medically. But many times you can't even be seen medically till I think it used to be when I went through this with my wife some, 16, 17 years ago now, you had to be trying for a year unless you had a previously known factor, which is also a challenge for many couples, no matter which of those three categories you fall into. People think now when they think of infertility, they think of IVF, in vitro fertilization, but that is only one that fall under the category of assisted reproductive technology or ART. Talk about the different types of assisted reproductive technology, even though we may center on talking more about IVF today.
Sure. Yes. So we have from least invasive to most invasive. We can do timed intercourse at home around ovulation. And then there's like ovulatory stimulation where there might be some oral pills that somebody's taking to kickstart ovulation. And then there's an IUI, which is where I am not involved in the medical treatment, but I say we because I imagine all these people being involved, where the patient would take some kind of usually ovulatory medication to stimulate their ovaries to make sure they're ovulating. And then there's the placement of washed sperm in the uterus through a catheter for an IUI. And then if that is unsuccessful or if they're not a good candidate for IUI, they might be a good candidate for IVF. And so when we get to IVF, lots of things happen in IVF and we can use, and even in an IUI, the discussion about whose sperm are we going to use. If you're in a different sex couple, you might be using your partner's sperm. If you're in a same sex couple, you might be using donor sperm or a known donor sperm. You could be in a different sex couple and be using donor sperm anyways, because your partner might have one of those male factor things that I mentioned. And then when we get to IVF, we can insert possibly donor egg because there might be some egg quality issues or diminished ovarian reserve that would require having to process the idea of using a known donor or a de-identified donor is what we call it these days, a donor that you wouldn't know or don't have the identity for. And then are we using our partner's sperm? Or are we using donor sperm? And so IVF opens the door to looking at lots of different scenarios of how baby and families can be built. And then we create an embryo and that embryo is placed into a uterus and it might be the intended mother's uterus or if you're using a gestational carrier, the gestational carrier's uterus. So lots of different ways. We also have donor embryo that is fairly new. So we have people who have their IVF journeys and their family is done, but they have extra embryos that they don't feel comfortable destroying. They have the option to donate to other couples. And there are some couples who choose to use donor embryo, which is an anonymous donation. sometimes there's known or semi-known donations, but most often they're anonymous donations. And they would transfer that donor embryo into a uterus as well.
Let's talk about the psychological impact of infertility on the couple relationship. What do you think are the biggest effects of that?
You named one already, and I think it's the element of surprise is big. We can't look inside of our bodies and see the quality of our eggs or the quality of our sperm. And so we don't really recognize it until we need it to work. And then we start testing it. And so when we get these results back that maybe it's not working as we expected it to, especially if we feel really healthy on the outside, we maybe don't have any other pre-existing conditions, and you get news that your egg quality is pretty low and you have to consider using an egg donor. Just the diagnosis alone, the amount of information that you're being told by your doctor in usually a pretty short amount of time. Those appointments with your doctor are very limited. And so people are turning to Google or Reddit, which aren't very helpful. And so helping couples just even process the shock and awe of what they just experienced. What does that mean for them in their relationship? What are their options? So I see a lot of couples who are considering third-party reproduction, which is like donor egg, donor sperm, donor embryo, or gestational carrier, just to get the language down. What does this even mean? Because it's a whole new lingo that they're having to learn. So on top of just the surprise, the shock and awe of what the diagnosis is, what this means, what are their options, usually leading up to that, because like you said, people are usually trying at home for quite a few months before they're seeing a doctor. So usually their sex life takes a pretty big toll because sex is no longer fun and spontaneous. It's usually timed and recorded on some log somewhere. And financially, it can be really difficult for couples. I've seen couples get a second mortgage on their home. They tap into their IRAs in retirement. They get a second, third job so they can get insurance that has maybe a little bit of reproductive coverage. They ask friends or family for money. It puts couples in very vulnerable situations financially to figure out how to make this happen. And then the social isolation, I think that's such a big one too, because couples just start to slowly pull away from their friend groups, especially if a lot of their friends are getting pregnant or trying to get pregnant, or there's baby showers or lots of family asking, when are you going to have a baby? They start to get a little bit more isolated, and then the couple relationship takes a lot of the brunt of the infertility grief and what comes with that. And then partners, we're all human. We all respond differently to this. Even though the couple's going through the same experience, they might have a very different process of it. And so they're going to respond differently to each other, even though they're doing the same thing. So all of this kind of impacts communication, sex life, emotional intimacy, financial, social. It can impact people's, I feel like their jobs, just their life in general. People schedule vacations around their cycles. They really rearrange their entire life around building their family. So it impacts couples at so many levels of their relationship.
As you were mentioning earlier, depending if it's female factor, male factor, or undefined, we often talk about in family systems there being an identified patient. So if it is clearly traced to one partner, the kind of unexpressed tension that causes as well, I think, can imbalance even the healthiest of relationships. So if this is really a couple issue, why do you think so much of the talk therapy around the medical treatment of infertility is done in an individual context? Obviously, this is an audience, many couple and family therapists in here. So you're speaking probably not only to an attachment friendly, EFT friendly audience, but also people that do a lot of couple and families work. But why is so much of this done individually if it really is a relational, a couple issue?
Yeah, I'm a bit biased. So I fit in that camp too. And every time someone contacts me for individual therapy around this, I'm always like, are you sure your partner doesn't want to join? Just in case, because I always feel like that's going to be beneficial. But that's not always the case. And traditionally, the person that's receiving the medical treatment is usually the one who's experiencing kind of the weight of the treatment process physically, emotionally. They're processing it very differently than their partner. And so I'll start with them individually. I have seen partners join many times. Just because as we're talking about things individually, they're realizing maybe they could talk about this differently at home. I'm also bringing the partner in, even though they're not there, like I'm saying, so how does your partner respond to this? Or what's their opinion about this? Or how do you talk to your partner about this at home? Or what words do you use with your partner at home when it comes to this? And so they start realizing, maybe I've been demanding my needs being met. I'm not really articulating why that's important to me. Maybe I could say that differently. So then I somehow can get the partner in through that avenue and we can do some couples work. But sometimes the individual may just want some space from their partner to talk about this. Again, that social isolation, sometimes the couple relationship really takes the brunt of it. The partner is talking about this all the time. It's always a part of their conversation. And sometimes their partner's like, I can't handle any more talk about fertility. Go see a counselor. Go find your own place to be able to talk about it. Sometimes their partner just isn't open to coming and talking about it because they're just done. So sometimes for my individual clients, they really just want their own space. They just want some space to talk about it. But if I can involve the partner, I always try to.
Another thing that is overwhelming, not only the cost, the amount of information you get, but when you are consulting with a fertility specialist, and I could speak to my, over the years, many clients' experience, but I'll speak to my own experience. And this was again around 17 years ago in Indianapolis, Indiana, where we went into the specialist, the statistic they used to determine a good fertility doctor is the amount of live births. But this gentleman, he was very good at what he did, but interpersonally, he was not very skilled, his bedside manner. So it was not only even for someone like me and my wife who understood the territory. My wife, like your husband, is also a clinician. It was somewhat sterile and overwhelming, but his nurse, who happened to also be his romantic partner, we found out after time, she was amazing. And she was interpersonally skilled and certainly could have been a therapist if she wanted to. I don't know how many fertility doctors talk about the importance not only of individual work, of couples work, and certainly depending what part of country you live in, they're integrated. I would always think like the best scenario would be, and maybe some of our listeners work in settings like this, where attached to the fertility specialist, there is a MFT or a mental health professional. I always think on this show of how to move the field forward. And I think that's why medical family therapists or systemic thinkers working in medical settings like this could really be helpful to normalize, as you said, what is so isolating for these couples, this idea to normalize couples going through this, like we said a couple minutes ago, have all these predictable things. And even on some level, I knew that, but even for me and my wife, it was somewhat overwhelming and isolating. So let's say we get into someone like you that has this background. What are the typical components, interventions associated with the couples therapy for infertility?
Yeah. And I would say your experience, even 17 years ago, is still an experience of a lot of people today. I will say that I think a lot of reproductive endocrinologists have become much more open to the idea of mental health and the importance of it. We also have so much more longitudinal data from people that are either used donor conception or just use fertility treatment in general and the mental health aspect of what they go through. When we think about patient dropout is most high and most often not because of financial reasons, which is what I would expect it to be, but it's due to emotional reasons. And so physicians have to pay attention to that because they also want patients in their clinic, right? And so if they know the way to slow down the dropout rates in their clinic is to provide some kind of mental health resources, that will keep patient retention there too, and just really serve a need of their patients. They're seeing this as a need of our patients that we're not meeting and they're having to leave and go somewhere else. I feel like reproductive endocrinologists are becoming much more attuned to the needs of their patients. They don't always have the skills or the time to be able to do that in their office. So we see people like the nurses that are, you know, kind of filling the gaps there, but are also really overworked and tired. And so then they are given my card or told my name and they come see me and they're like overwhelmed with all of the things, all of the diagnoses, the questions. They don't know what kind of treatment they're going to do. How do we talk to friends and family about that? And so by the time they get to my office, a lot of what I'm doing is just about their reproductive story. that everybody has some kind of reproductive story, whether you thought about it 5 minutes or whether you've spent 5 years working to build your family. Everyone has thought about it in that I want children or I don't want to have children. That's not a part of my story. Maybe that took you 30 seconds to decide, but it's still a reproductive story. You've had to think about it. So oftentimes I'll ask couples, just share with me a little bit about your family planning goals or walk me through what it was like making that decision. I ask this question a lot, like, how has your relationship weathered this? That's what I'm most curious about, right? Is how has your relationship weathered this? And what did it take to make the decisions that you're making? What's the cost been in your relationship? So I ask some of these questions just on the front end because it's helpful for me to assess where they're at. I also want to know, are they still committed that they to one to each other? I feel like it's always important to revisit. Are they still committed to each other? But are they still in agreement that they want to proceed ahead? Because there are some couples who get a diagnosis and it makes them hesitate for a second. Is this what we want to do? And can we afford this? And at what cost to our relationship? Or have they lost sight of the desire to move ahead? So these are some of the questions that I would ask on the front end just to get a baseline of where they're.
So there's so much there. What stage are they in? And are they just in the early process of getting the information, feeling overwhelmed? Have they tried these less costly and intensive forms of assisted reproductive technology before they go to the IVF? How willing are they, both the emotional burden, the financial burdens? Let's talk an EFT framework, which I knew you had, which a lot of times a hallmark of EFT, a primary and secondary emotion. So one partner may look indifferent or one partner may be frustrated or angry, but underneath that, these primary emotions of insecurity, guilt, even shame, if they are the partner carrying the infertility, share how you work with that and maybe some powerful clinical stories of how you integrate these tenets of EFT to working with these couples.
Yeah, good question. And I wrote about this in several different places. And I feel one of the things I love about EFT is it doesn't matter what population you're working with. As Sue used to say, we're all chicken in the same chicken soup. And it applies to this too. It's attachment needs are activated under times of distress. I think anyone that's experienced infertility would define that as a season of distress. And so we see attachment needs get activated during times of infertility. And that makes sense. It's a very human part of the process. And so one of the things that I do, because EFT is built on an attachment foundation, is I'm listening for how they're telling their story. So in those initial kind of assessment questions, they sound pretty cognitive. So I'm listening with one ear to actually what the words are that they're saying, because I'm curious about how they're doing with all those things. But I'm also listening with my other clinical ear, my theoretical ear, of how are they telling their story and how does this fit into kind of their personal narrative through life? What's the lens that they're using to view the world around them, their partner, their situation? Are people genuinely there for them? Are they not? Do they expect people to be there for them? Is the world a safe place to them, a dangerous place to them? So that kind of helps me just theoretically ground myself a little bit into how are they perceiving this distress? When I teach this, I often tell people it's the experience and perception of infertility that determines the level of distress. Because not everyone goes through fertility treatment and their relationship is a mess and they're feeling lots of relational pain. That's not necessarily true. It's the experience and our perception of what infertility is and is it doing it to us or for us or how is our partner in those moments that really determines the level of distress we're going to feel. And so I'm listening to all of that. Are they open to comfort? Are they open to regulation individually as a couple? So I'm listening for that with one ear. And then I'm also, of course, doing a lot of these EFT interventions. So working through the tango, when I was trained, it was not called the tango. I've had to change all my language. As Sue has updated it, it was always the communication cycle or the negative dance. And now it's the tango. Same thing, just different words put on it. But so working through each of those five steps with them and helping them name and tame and then creating enactments around it, all of this applies. And it's just different content. It's maybe not about just regular communication issues. It's about infertility, but it's the same feelings that are being triggered. So those same primary feelings that you mentioned, whether it's fear, usually fear is a big one, sadness, anger, those shame and guilt, those are usually what's lying underneath. It's sometimes anger secondary, but sometimes primary. But so helping the couple take that elevator down from secondary to primary to realize, ooh, it's probably not the secondary I'm showing you that's going to be the most helpful to articulate my needs. I need to drop it down into primary to be able to talk more effectively about this.
And I think another thing we should say is 24 years ago, I wasn't necessarily trained this way when working with a premarital couple to talk about if you could not have a child naturally, what means would you go to, which ties into a lot of values, which I think hopefully is being adapted into more traditional premarital education. I'll give you another example that came into my office very recently, and we can use this framework. So this is a young couple, but this couple had not had the premarital work, and it happened to be a male factor. And the woman, using our EFT language, it was a frequent pattern that we see in all couples therapy of pursuer, distancer, demand, withdrawal. The woman was very angry because the husband's secondary emotion on the surface was very flippant, stonewalling, disengaged, and they had now entered in this. It was male factor. He had poor motility and poor count. She was completely healthy. So she's, I'm having to do all of this to my body, which is another stressor we didn't necessarily mention, the diagnostic stuff, and not only the hormones and what a woman needs to do to prepare her body to be able to undergo something like IVF. So she was very angry and explicit. All you had to do is give a sperm sample. You're not even going with me to the appointments. You don't care. And they were very gridlocked. And the more she got angry and pursued, the more he shut down. So whether we use a language from the model like blame or soften or whatever, how would you work with a couple like that? And they were really letting this split them. And both of them wanted to be parents, but boy, on the surface, that cycle was pretty ugly. How would you work with a couple like that?
Yeah, it's a great case study. So if we use EFT language, I would probably approach it with a mini blamer softening first, right? Because she's going to be talking. She really wants you to hear how hard this has been for her, how alone she's feeling. And so I can't do a full blamer softening because I don't have a withdrawal re-engagement, but I'm going to do a mini blamer softening so I can get a little bit of space to actually bring husband out. And so I'm going to look at her and I'm going to be able to say, this has been so hard for you. And I hear you, this has been so hard for you. And you've done so much and you want this so bad. It's so hard to feel like he's not there for you. Yeah. So being able to do a mini blamer softening so she knows I'm not going to drop her, but I also can't fully go there because there's so much that's happening for the husband that he probably can't articulate for lots of reasons. And maybe we're feeling that in the room as therapists, right? Because she's talking and she's telling us all the things. And then I move to him. And so I'm holding her with one hand. You can't see me, but I'm doing all my hand motions. I'm holding her with one hand, being able to remind her that she's seen and she's heard and her experience will not be left. But I'm going to turn to the husband and I'm going to be, how has this been for you? What's this like for you? Hearing your wife say this, but I might not even say hearing your wife say this. I'm probably just going to say, what's this been like for you? And what I imagine is that in working with him and being able to hold the pursuer at bay a little bit, and give him enough room to come out. If we could take the elevator down, there's probably lots of shame, probably lots of fear of what this actually means. Maybe he hasn't had a space to process this. Men process, and this is some anecdotally, but there's some research here too, but men process male factor fertility just very differently than like a female factor fertility. There's lots more shame and guilt that go with male factor. And so I'd be very curious about that. So I'd want to start with him. It might take a little bit to be able to have him start to name and tame some of those primary emotions, but that's what I want to help evoke, name and tame in a way that he feels comfortable, and then start to very gently slice it thinner to be able to have some kind of enactment where I can help him tell her these things. And maybe she could hear his experience in a new way, that it's actually much more involved for him. Maybe not physically. Physically, she, of course, is going to be doing more, but emotionally, it might be just as involved for him as it is for her.
We also mentioned this earlier, but I think it's worth noting many times, as we said, a couple doesn't know they're going to be on this journey. So the surprise factor when they embark on starting a family, however, times when we're talking about an LGBTQ population, more times than not, they know that they are going to need some type of assisted reproductive technologies. How do you think the work is both similar and different when working with LGBTQ populations?
Yeah, I think one of the big differences you just mentioned is that oftentimes their journey is just inherently intentional most of the time. They know, and they've often done quite a bit of research and had some time to plan. So they've had time to get their finances in order. They have a community of people who they have been talking to that have maybe done something similar. So they have lots of good support. They've had time to research maybe a surrogacy agency or an egg donor agency or a sperm donor agency. So when I meet with couples in the LGBTQ population, I find that they're oftentimes much more well-researched and prepared than different sex couples because they've known they're going to need some kind of assistance. Now, sometimes these cases can also be complex because they're having to make decisions about if you have a same-sex lesbian couple, it could be, are we doing reciprocal IVF? Whose eggs are we using? Whose uterus are we using? Oftentimes, again, couples have talked about this in advance, and so they can make these decisions pretty easily. And or whose sperm are we going to use? Are we going to use a known donor? And then that's more complicated. And I think, too, that oftentimes in the LGBTQ population, they can experience more discrimination at clinics. A lot of the brochures or the pictures in the waiting room or sometimes even the physicians and how they're speaking may be just a little bit more cisnormative or heteronormative. And so they can feel a little left out with that. The legal aspects can also be different for LGBTQ people just because the laws can vary by state as far as parentage and who the parents are and who's listed on birth certificates. And I do not give legal advice, but I often recommend legal consultation to a reproductive attorney that can walk them through what it means in their state and what they need to be working on, sometimes even prior to pregnancy, to make sure that they're both on the birth certificate if that's what they want.
I think one of the most challenging things for me personally to sit with is, again, back to the staging of where the couple is, where you meet them and they have gone through many times multiple unsuccessful rounds of IVF or whatever, and the journey has come to an end. So you're sitting with them and really being a part of their grief work. So let's talk about, I don't want to end on a bummer, so we'll end a bit, but let's talk about what I think is some of the most challenging work, especially in my personal life, and it sounds like yours, going through the ups and downs, but at the end, I have a healthy family of four, and I would not regret any of the time, the money, the emotional roller coaster we went on to get there. But all couples are not that lucky, and the journey may end childless. So let's talk about that work, which I think is MFT seeing these couples, you know, that you will certainly get a lot of that as well. So let's talk about what that looks like.
Yeah, it is a very difficult one to sit with. And I think that all couples arrive there at their own time. And I think our own countertransference is so important to be addressing through any kind of reproductive work. We all have strong opinions. And especially when we have our own journey, we may have strong opinions about what we think they should be doing or shouldn't be doing. And so we may think they should have ended treatment 6 months before they decided to. But for us being able to be reminded how important it is for the couple to make this decision on their own, even though it's so painful to sit through, yes, ending treatment, deciding when to end treatment is very difficult. What I have found is that couples are usually very intentional about making that decision. It's not a very fast or flippant decision. They've worked their way through treatment to get to that decision. But there's so much grief involved. What can be hard is when one partner is wanting to end treatment and the other is not. I find that even worse to sit with sometimes than when they both decided and we can grieve together. But it's very hard to sit with one couple or with a couple where one partner wants to do just one more round and the other partner says, I don't think I can do it. Remaining child-free or childless, there's lots of different terms that people are using these days, can be a really sad decision for some, but it can be really empowering for others to be able to really close the door on this season of their life, whether it's been pretty traumatic or whether it's been a pretty easy decision for them. Closing the door can really help come full circle for them.
And redefining what their life looks like and a new shared dream, because in many relationships, no matter how caring or competent the clinician is, that was the only glue holding them together. Many relationships will not be able to survive that. But I believe the ones that do, and just my anecdotal clinical experience, are people that have been able to develop a new shared dream and give meaning to their life. And we could do a whole nother show on adoption and the roller coaster that goes there. But some couples I've worked with, again, their desire to have a natural child is so strong that they do not want to explore avenues. Other people, adoption then becomes a viable alternative. But even that road, again, while it is in the scope of our practice as couples therapists, as MFTs, to do this work, certainly we need education, not only what we've been talking about this hour, but also adoption and what comes after assisted reproductive technology, MFTs, couples therapists doing this work. If this is what you want to do and you don't have the connections that Christy had or being able to be mentored by Sue Johnson, I think, as I was saying earlier, if you can form a relationship with a fertility doctor or a team, because even today we just touched the surface and I get educated through the couples that I work with, but also with fertility doctors that I consult with. And it becomes a mutually beneficial relationship because not only does it help referrals, I get knowledge from them. They get knowledge from me about the stuff we've been talking about today and how we work psychotherapeutically with couples. I was telling you before the interview, so much has changed with IVF. I'll give you an example. But one of the biggest things that I've learned over the last couple of years, it used to be live transfer that we're talking about in IVF was the gold standard. And now it is very different. Frozen embryos is the gold standard. So that is something that as the technology has changed, we always, even though, as I said earlier, this is in the scope of our practice of MFTs, we have to keep updating ourselves to stay in the scope of our competence, as you always hear me say on the show, if you're a listener. So I think having a relationship and building a relationship with providers, with fertility specialists, is essential for me. And before we sign off, I'm just curious your thoughts on that, Christy.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, you don't need to know this stuff until you need to know it. And sometimes it can feel overwhelming when you're trying to educate yourself on this area. Also, if you're having your own experience, you're going to learn just personally, but don't overwhelm yourself to learn this professionally too. Sometimes you need to go through your own journey first and then engage it professionally and what that means. But absolutely having a mentor, finding a supervisor, getting yourself into some trainings, finding a physician that you could connect with, or finding someone who is connected with a fertility clinic that you could get some mentorship from, those can always be a very helpful thing for sure. But also knowing that a good training and foundation in just like a therapeutic modality in general is just gold these days. I'm a theory nut. I really feel very strongly about counselors and MFTs having a strong theoretical orientation. I feel like these days everybody's pulling from everywhere else, but having a strong theoretical orientation that you can conceptualize clients and it makes sense and it informs your treatment. It doesn't matter if they're coming to you with infertility or something else. That's really going to educate you so much in your treatments, along with getting the extra education on the nuances of fertility counseling and what it is. Having a good theoretical orientation is just really important too.
What do you think are the best resources for systemic therapists out there who want more training and knowledge in this area of what we've been talking about today?
Yeah, there is some limited training out there. So that's been the problem, is we're trying to set a high standard for people who are wanting to enter the fertility counseling field of just understanding some of the reproductive basics. And even though you and I might have went through some of the same fertility treatments, I can't assume my experience is the same as yours or yours the same as mine. So really making sure we educate ourselves and being open to other people's experience, even of the same thing. So I, along with my colleague, Dr. Laura Cummington, we run a 10-month postgraduate course. So we do ask that you're done with your graduate program. You don't have to be licensed yet, if I remember right, but you do have to have graduated grad school. But it's a 10-month course where we take a very in-depth look at fertility counseling, and we go all the way from the medical diagnosis to how to work with third party to how to do surrogacy evaluations to the legal and ethics of this work. It's a really fun course. It meets once a month. It's live. It's interactive. We have a peer group that meets in between. We do case studies. People from all over the world take the course. So we just started around in September. We'll take applications for next September, but that's a really fun place. There are some limited trainings. I've done some CE trainings through PESI and Psychotherapy Networker. I did one through, I think it was PESI, that's more focused on just EFT and attachment with fertility work. So that might be more interesting to systemic people just because it's more theoretically based. And then there are the newly edited fertility counseling books. These are the main foundational texts of fertility counseling. There's the clinical guide and a case studies book, which I think is a great addition this year. And those are put out by Cambridge Press. I have a couple chapters in those books. And they're authored by wonderful leading experts in the field. And so you get to hear lots of different voices in those the clinical guide and the case studies, which I think is really fun. So those are some of the opportunities that I know of. And you can always email me and I can try to help you find a training that would fit your needs too. So
yeah, we always ask that the dialogue will want to continue. So since you brought that up, best way to contact you?
Probably my business email. It's probably easiest that I'm like an email queen. It's easier to email me than to get me on the phone sometimes. And so you can find me at my business email. So it's Aporia, A-P-O-R-I-A at aporiaconsulting.com. You can also Google my name and find my website. There's a contact form you can, and that goes right to me. So maybe that's even easier just to head to my website. There's also some resources on my website too. I sell some courses and different things on there that could be interesting to do on your own time.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Did you know that AAMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AAMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AAMFT? You can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcast and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years.
You can drop me a line. ELIKARAM.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including I have two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking. And it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors, you want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.